accession number 19387, reel 3.
Tony Perrins, reel 3.
String verse, there were two arguments. I never saw the point of them. But again, I was somewhat privileged. There are others, and I think the ones that are really the sharp end, and most people appear to appreciate string verse as being very warm. I just found them so uncomfortable, but again, I didn't have a restrictions. I didn't have to carry all my gear. I could carry more sweaters than the people in the front line. But basically, as far as I was concerned, looking back at it, and now having had some experience about foul weather gear, they were very badly equipped. If you can imagine doing duty albeit with a string vest, a shirt, a pullover, a jacket and an overcoat and a balaclava helmet, it's not enough to keep you physically or mentally alert at 3 o'clock in the morning when the temperatures are pushing minus 50 or 60. I do remember being on duty one night in battalion headquarters with command battalion command post. I and the signaller and the clerk sitting around an Aladdin stove. Well, hell, I don't know if the army issued Aladdin stoves or not. If they did, the man in the war office who was responsible should have been taken out and shot. We sat around, the three of us, 4 o'clock in the morning, I suppose it was, with the stove, sort of basically between our legs, and we were just mentally and physically numb.
So these stoves are totally inadequate?
Oh, inadequate. That is absurd. If I can, you know, I remember shortly after thinking, you know, if a Chinaman had walked in and said boo, I couldn't have said boo back. I mean, the whole thing was absurd. And I can remember sitting there with my elbows on my knees and my hands clasped in front of me, and you would nod off and your hands would fall on the Aladdin stove, which would be a sufficient shock to make you wake up. Whereupon you went there. Horrible. Anyhow. The one thing that where we varied from the Americans was that the Americans gave up shaving. We gave up shaving to the point where nobody was, it didn't have to be shaved before noon. You were allowed until noon to, I say allow, this was something that was put in motion by Kingsley Foster. I have no idea what other battalions did, but other than I'm reasonably certain that the British Army shaved every day. One of the things I remember was that King's Regulations was not very clear on what had to be shaved. And I know Paddy Baxter, who was still alive, he had forgotten what you...
A moustache?
I can't remember what his job was. He was not in the company, but he was... I was going to say MTO, but he wasn't MTO. It doesn't matter what he was. The question was, how long can your moustache be? Can your moustache actually join up with your sideburns? And Paddy used to have about somewhere between a 16th and an 1/8 of an inch between between his sideburns and his moustache. He did shave his chin, I must admit. But that shows you how sort of infantile we all became at least. We would play these stupid games. This is a means of remaining sane. But we all shaved. And were expected to be shaved. And the Americans gave that up for Lent or something. You know. Anyhow, we remained at Piontech. The other part of Piontech was the fact of the refugees. While we were there, guarding it's in the records, like 2,000 yards or something up front, or more, we were either side of the MSR and the railway line. And all these Koreans came on south. And they would moan the whole time, understandably. And you had this constant moaning. You were just this wave, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Koreans trying to get south. And we wouldn't allow them to move at night. And they were suffering through the same temperature and probably less prepared for it than we were. There would be the moaning, which used to keep it front of the troops in the front line. They'd be kept awake at night, even when off duty, with this moaning. And of course, the ones during the day when we allowed them south, you had no idea whether they were friendly or enemy. And again, I can remember ordering the only way we could do it, I remember battalion headquarters, they were coming down, we were off just by the railway line. We would just arbitrarily pick out a bunch. That was just no reason at all. You just decide to take 10 out. And again, I noticed the soldiery just didn't like be nasty. And you'd have to force the soldiers to search them properly. They just didn't like to be beastly. Even though their lives depended on it.
Was anything found?
Occasionally you found somebody with a rifle or something. But there again, you didn't know whether he was it was a family rifle which he was trying to save, or all desperately unsatisfactory.
What happened to the people with the rifles?
That's interesting. Is that in the war diary in the brigade, 29 Brigade War Diary, there is comment that we are to deal harshly with refugees found to be carrying arms. And while reading it, I had made a note what exactly, please define harshly. It was, I'm reasonably certain that nobody wanted to define harshly. They wanted to pass the buck.
Were they hinting at shooting them?
I don't know. Well, I have no idea what we were supposed to do. We didn't. But it becomes interesting to me when I then read very recently about, well, obviously Black Sunday paratroop people in Northern Ireland, but in Kosovo. You have private soldiers being charged with shooting civilians. Well, they claim self-defense, and I don't know, but you can't, I'm sorry.
But did the Koreans with rifles, were they handed over to police?
Yeah, we handed them over to field security. Who knows what ever happened? I've no idea. And we were very happy to get them off our hands.
So you're talking about the
only reason I bring the whole subject up is war is a messy business, and unless you've lived through it, I can understand why you don't, why people do not understand the difficulties. But the idea of blaming private soldiers who, if they had, to put it bluntly, college educations and high intelligence, the chances are they wouldn't be private soldiers on the front line. We're asking too much of people. As far as I'm concerned, if a private soldier in Kosovo says that he fired on a civilian because of he felt that his life was in danger, I'd have to accept it. Unless there was some obviously contrary evidence that staring you in the face. But anyhow, none of which has anything to do with Korea.
I think so. I think it has. So, we're up to the refugees pouring through.
Well, they pour all the way through. And then, some weeks later, we move on. And though I... What happened in February and March, I have no, there are no highlights of, and I've, you know, I probably know more about the war diary, the actual detail, than most people. And even now I can't tell you if there's nothing of any credence. We moved, we fought a little, but not much. And we chased everybody back to be emptied, basically. We or somebody else forced the Chinese back from way south of the Han River back to the Imjin line. And that was going on between February and March of 1951. We, in fact, it's all, we were back there in March, and sat. No, I'm wrong. No. We were still fiddling around. We were in Yongdongpo in March, moving around. Okay, then we basically we move up to the Imogen, and there we for reasons looking back at it, and this is strictly, I do not understand why we didn't dig in and put up wire, etc., on the Imogen before the Imogen battle. I don't know why. Other than I think it was probably a case of nobody knew how long we were going to be there, and it was assumed that we were going to, and when I say assumed, I'm talking about a brigade level, assumed that nobody was going to stay there very long. And I can't remember ever a battalion ever using wire prior to, after the Imogen battle. I can't remember that because I wasn't there, but I, in the war diary I noticed in May and June they were spent an immense amount of time digging and stringing wire and putting in mines and that sort of thing. I don't think, I think I can honestly say I never saw a mine the whole time I was there. But I left in April and went north, so I didn't. Prior to that, mines and wire was not a feature of our lives at all. There's absolutely no mention in the war diary at all about it.
Well, slit trenches were dug.
Oh yeah, slit trenches. That was all. And but certainly no mines, no wire. Trip wire. People did trip wires. But that was basically sort of, you know, hanging a can with a pebble did tripwire and trip flares. Although they did have trip flares, but there again, I was it was nigh on 50 years ago, and I was intelligence officer, not a platoon commander. So somebody who was a platoon commander could and may well have done already. You probably got that on tape, but I don't know. Anyhow, we get the Imogen River battle, and which others must have spoken about, and chaos. But reverting back to something I said earlier, we did not know where the Chinese were, where the enemy was. We had no idea. Sometime, probably on April the 21st, 20th, 21st, possibly 22nd, but I don't think so, flew in an Auster north over the Imogen looking for the enemy. And our sole purpose was to get some sighting of the enemy. And you got the impression, if nobody would have worried very much if we'd been shot down, as long as they knew where we'd been shot down, as long as the pilot had enough time to radio back where we were when we were shot down, they would have been interested. We did not see anything. And we were flying low. I mean, horses don't fly very high anyhow, but we certainly weren't making any effort to fly high. And we were flying slowly, and we were searching. And a certain amount of snow on the ground. And we saw nobody. All that happened was one person unknown and unseen fired one round, which whistled past. We heard it crack past the earthplane. That was it. I assume that he was whoever did it was probably chastised like hell after the event. But we never saw it. We never saw them. And after I was captured, I learned how they did it. Whole platoons would run down the street, down the road, dirt track, whatever, carrying a Christmas tree. And the first son of an aeroplane, they all crouched down and held their Christmas tree above them. And so when you flew over, all you saw was a whole bunch of Christmas trees you didn't see. Platoons would carry, or sections, would carry long white sheets, a roll of cotton, white cotton material, in the snow. And if they heard it, they just jumped in their ditch and unfurled the roll of white material, put it over their heads, and just sat there until the plane went away. As you went north, as I did as a prisoner, they had guards, or sentries, who would hear an aircraft, and they'd fire a rifle. And that warned everybody. Well, that's one shot. That warned everybody, and then everybody would listen. And then the next sentry would be listening, and he'd hear it, he'd fire. All the trucks would pull off the road, turn out what little lights they had, and would hide all the way down on the MSRs. They had camouflage lay-bys. The trucks would pull in and just hide underneath this camouflage. Not sophisticated, they would just have a lot of poles stuck up and covered with evergreen material, you know, trees, limbs, and that sort of thing. And that's how they did it. So after the event, I now know why I didn't see anything. They were there. On the 22nd of April, they started their work, thousands of them. Certainly everybody in my regiment behaved extremely well. And
what did you see of the battle yourself?
I didn't see a bloody thing until the last 5 minutes or something, as far as I was concerned. The companies were, you know, what we, in our case, as indeed with the Gloucesters and the Ulster Rifles, the amount of frontage we were, it's all well documented, but we had 2.5 miles or something. We had a very large frontage. And so we would the companies, the four rifle companies, were fully occupied. Back at battalion headquarters, we were just looking after them, making quite sure that food and intelligence and whatever was got to the troops and the ammunition and that. But as far as seeing anything other than a few wounded coming back, never heard it. I never saw it, rather. You didn't hear very much either, I mean, because the distances were so great. I heard the guns going, of course. But,
so what happened in the last 5 minutes to you?
Well, we back. This won't make much sense on this one. Knows the layout and the terrain and the maps and what we were doing, but the battalion headquarters moved, and I think I'm right in saying, 3 steps before the final withdrawal. The night of the 24th of April, I was back at B. Echelon. Again, it was my night off that night, and when it was your night on, you were on. I mean, you just go to bed. And I'd been on duty on the night of the 23rd. And David Brooke took over on the, he was the adjutant, took over on the 24th. And I went back to B. Echelon. Just to get some sleep. Which was the intent. And I got back to B. Echelon, I don't know, 10 or 11 o'clock at night, or something. Went to bed. And I think I got a shower too, which was very nice. And went to bed, was woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning and told I had to report to brigade headquarters at 5 o'clock or some morning. Which I got up, and my jeep driver and I went to brigade. And Tom Brody, the brigade commander, I was attending on behalf of the colonel. Tom Brady's O group. And you hear criticism of Tom Brody. He's a hero of mine. I always thought he was wonderful. And I can remember, looking back at it, I was amazing. Here was a man whose brigade was just about to be wiped off the face of the earth. And he manages to... they apologized when I arrived, anyhow. The brigade major said, Tom will be with you in a moment. And he comes in, and he calls you by your first name. Which was a nice, and to me, I remember being how nice it is.